Did you not sleep so well last night?
No question.
Oh.
No, no question.
It's okay.
9 hours.
Still 9 hours. Good? Yeah.
9 hours sleep. Not any question. No, not sleep. Just relax. That I need. Okay.
Well, so if you need relax, please feel free to relax this morning. However, you know, the wind has shifted. Yes.
Since childhood, it is my nature. If something I saw, immediate response, why, how. So, during sleep, dream, analyze.
Ah.
So that's part of, say, first day, my habit. So not relax does not mean just because of some kind of
thoughtless state.
Then I think I want to tell Riji, thoughtlessness alone is wasting our brain. Isn't it?
So today the wind has shifted. I think it may be coming from Tibet. It's a little colder today. We're going to shift topics also.
Okay.
Yes. Today the focus is ethics and compassion. And we're going to hear from Rob Roser, who's from Penn State University. He's going to review some scientific findings. Very interesting. They address issues, for example, like why, if infants, young infants, prefer kindness, is it so difficult for adults to extend love to everyone? And many other issues. Matthew Ricard, who you know well, will speak about some of the scientific data that he's reviewed in his work on empathy and compassion, and then the Buddhist view. And then Sona Dimidjian, who you heard yesterday, will give some research about teaching compassion to adults like parents and teachers and how important that is. But in order to set the stage, Your Holiness, I'm going to turn to you because, of course, we as scientists and educators, we humbly understand that you represent an ancient tradition that has deep grounding in compassion and the methods for compassion.
Grounding.
And that it's designed to free the mind so that we can best be of help to other people. And in that spirit, you've put forth the model of secular ethics, which is not for Buddhists, but for everyone in the world. And it's for many people, this is a new term. They don't understand what that means. So I wonder if you would be kind enough to explain to us and to start the day what you mean by secular ethics and why it might be so important for people of the 21st century, today's children.
I think that the first day, I already mentioned a lot of problems. Essentially, our own creation. And the people consider troublemaker when they are a child. Not like that. As the other day I mentioned one occasion, some scientists now they sort of through the sort of observation or sort of study the basic human nature is more compassionate. So now why we are compassionate in nature and yet a lot of problems our own creation. Why? The lack of, I feel, today, those troublemakers, I think one way, lack of holistic view. They just pick up one sort of, because of the evident, because of the one instant or one thing, just narrowly. So, if that person, you see, they try to look that same problem from wider perspective, that problem not so significant, then automatically reduce the irritation, anger. So that's, I think, wisdom sight. Animal know that sort of ability. We human beings have the sort of ability to look from wider perspective. And also, you see, we have the ability to think, if I react this way, after 1 week, a few months, or years, or even centuries, what kind of consequences? We have the ability. So education, you see, now make clear these things. Then you see people who are very narrow-minded and short-sighted, not thinking consequences, long future, and also they, the famous word, interdependency, the negative thing, not absolute or independent, but due to many other factors. So once you see, understand these things, then the destructive emotion, very narrow-minded. Now I may use one word, Buddhism. Buddhist philosophy, you see, say these destructive emotion, all destructive emotion based on ignorance. So no reason, just emotion. The positive emotion, there is a reason, not based on ignorance. So ignorance cannot go with wisdom. The positive, because of the emotion, can go side by side with wisdom. Like that. So therefore, education is key factor. Now, I often used to mention, I am Buddhist. I never say Buddhism is best. And even sometimes I am a little bit critical about different religious tradition, including Buddhism. You see, develop. We Buddhist. And then hit other people. Wrong. Those great masters, including Buddha and Muhammad and Jesus Christ, when they taught, you see, a spiritual tradition according to their own experience, they never meant for more problem, more quarrel. No. Anyone who follow one of these traditions, if create problem that actually against their own teacher. Now then, no matter how nice these different, like Buddhism, the 7 billion human beings never can be Buddhist. Although we pray all sentient beings reach Buddhahood. That means all sentient beings eventually become Buddhist. That's just a prayer. Just a prayer. Just wishful thinking. I think Buddha himself, I think, not only pray, but he made a real effort and he become enlightened Buddhahood. But his wish never materialized. But individual person, that thinking, I think the other day I mentioned, I think a person who practice altruism with reason, not just a faith. Jigden dungen chinyeba, tegu rangden delejong. Jigden dewa chinyeba, tegu shanden delejong.
So Shantideva has captured this in a very beautiful way, where he says that whatever problems you see in the world are ultimately rooted in extreme self-centeredness, mm-hmm. and whatever happiness mm-hmm. there is in the world is really a function of other-centeredness.
Then, on top of that, we are social animal. We human being. And then the way our life, survival or grow, is entirely dependent on others' love. Without that, we can't survive. That's human nature. Some story mentioned some great sort of saint born from lotus. I doubt. That person may have more compassion towards lotus rather than human being. Aryadeva Juju Sigore. Lord Bama is Juju.
So there's a story in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition that Aryadeva, Nagarjuna's chief disciple, as well as Padmasambhava, the great master who came to Tibet, both of them are born spontaneously in a lotus. So His Holiness feels that sometimes these kind of statements, rather than being a compliment, can in fact be a sort of a insult.
So we, social animal, now particularly today's world, east depend west, west depend east, because east, similarly north and south. That's today's reality. When we heard, you see, the climate condition changing, global warming, it really brings now, I'll say, the seriousness. Now time come. We have to work together and live mm-hmm. happily. That's much better. I think our future limited, not only my own life, but whole humanity, after a few thousand, will go. So remaining few thousand, much better live happily, harmoniously. So occasionally, there is potential because of our brain. A lot of different ideas, including different religion. So the source of division, source of problem, there. So now, what to do is, you see, when we find some differences, then it's respect others, other as a human brothers, sisters, and respect their view. Not my view is right, their view is wrong. Not say that. The variety of people. Therefore, I usually call this century should be century of dialogue. Whenever we find differences, basically we are same human being. Basically we have to live together, side by side. So then try to reduce these differences or source of conflict, try to reduce through dialogue. So this 21st century should be a century of dialogue. So our work, you see, educate people. You see, the ultimate source of happy individual, happy family, happy community, finally happy humanity, even you see happy world, ultimately depend on warm-heartedness. This not just the religious people's concern, but entire human being. Like that. So I think dogs, we can teach some extent, I think, loving kindness. Mosquito, I don't know. As I mentioned yesterday, I don't know. I think many mammals, I think the dogs like dog. So one dog, no matter how sort of strong physical sort of structure, but more peaceful, then surrounded by more dogs. Those dogs who always barking to other dog, always isolate. That's against basic nature, social animal. We human being, you see, do the one's own because of the pride. Right. I'm something special. Then, actually, in your mind, you feel isolation. So therefore, I never consider me as a Dalai Lama or something special. I never consider. I always consider myself as a human being. So, with that feeling, wherever I go, when I meet someone, I feel, oh, human brother, my sister. Always laughing, always teasing, like that. That really brings my own joyful. If I consider I'm Dalai Lama, something very special, oh, then I myself make isolation. Then meet other people, oh, little suspicion. Result, I suffer.
No, it's on. Yeah, I'm just muting it when I'm coughing. So what Shanideva said earlier that was cited is truly right, that all the problems in the world are ultimately rooted in extreme self-centeredness. So when, as on the individual level, if someone is so obsessed with just me alone, then the problems become bigger and bigger.
As I mentioned, I think yesterday or yesterday briefly, even you see those of the paintings or statues in our tantric practice, the wrathful deities there. According to my own sadhana, some experience about altruism. So look from there, looking from that, because of
that angle.
That angle. Then wrathful deity, not much meaning. Entire sentient being is our friend.
So if you take the ideal of, you know, universal compassion and altruism seriously, then you can't even make sense of the idea that there might be enemies, real enemies out there. So there are phrases like, you know, enemy of the Buddha Dharma and all of this. So for someone who truly takes compassion idea seriously, you can't
selfish,
make sense of this.
Anger, narrow-minded, these are true enemy. Even enemy of Buddha Dharma, enemy of all religions, enemy of humanity. So, including my own negative emotion, these are truly Dagirisha.
So those are the true enemies. Him.
Those being, the nyumu bishawan to jyotili ninji kiyari mado, the Dagirisha pa sarja kagimido.
So the sentient beings who are under the dominance of these powerful emotions, they are objects deserving of our compassion. If we are going to be angry at, it should be really at the forces that make them and, you know, behave in a particular way.
Sounds cutting though. Cause we doesn't get lemon swing. Shekum by a civil session draw another divish. Yeah, Shani. Shekum by a civil session was saying, this is he told me to us. Did this do? Did this do? Did this do? Did that? Go taste it, take it. 상황치디디 딱 도저히 숨나러라 폐질 시계 원자세야 되시라라 되죠 말이야. 나초 나러리야 다 강사 지 크두크두 다지 가서 감도 매버도 뛰니 시계 원자세도 숨셔시. 제대로니 가서 지선 가서 지지기 가서 뒤에지 터도 지진 먼저 처음 미우선 것 가서 독순 거대 독순 거대 지야 신문대 주문대 형을 재미도 자상에 대 잠시 장주고 섬사리 쇼 싸움당하는 현도자네 당근은 먼저 십시 다 좀 붙이다 지 이름 잡고 신심 붙이 제다 그렇게 해서 미도 섬좀
차용 그 Zolinus is confirmed.
One Chinese Chajus and the Tony Dobati, Tony Dow, that thing, one Chinese, the Remother Shan, that Tawashi, them she's called Hamburgi, Chow Major Choice, Sin initiating here. It's a Chujuku, sometimes Sabato to Jew.
So he's conferring with his monastic colleagues and, you know, sharing them his view that if you take compassion seriously and the ideal of altruism seriously, then we need to look at this imagery, iconography of very wrathful, fierce-looking deities and understand them in a particular context because we can't see them and as truly being angry at sentient beings, you know, really more at. And he feels that in the Buddhist practice, what is most important are really bodhicitta, the aspiration to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, grounded in universal compassion.
Infinite altruism.
And then the view of emptiness. So those are the two that really matter.
Understanding ultimate reality. That really bring conviction. All destructive emotion is a wrong view, based on ignorance. Very helpful. Therefore, quantum physics, I feel, very helpful. Regarding
so reducing our tendency to grasp a thing as black and white.
Yes, not too much.
No, thank you, Your Holiness. That was wonderful. Rob
Rose.
His Holiness was saying that it's, you know, of course he's tired and he gets tired, but on that, then once he opens his mouth, then it takes a while for him to close it.
You know, luckily we're very interested what comes out of that mouth. So thank you. Rob, please.
Yes, well, good morning, Your Holiness. It's an honor of a lifetime, perhaps many lifetimes, to be with you today to talk with you about educating the heart. And I just want to say thank you on behalf of so many scientists and educators and children who've already been touched by your love and leadership in this regard, including myself and so many here. We're so grateful. So, and I also want to thank the Mind and Life Institute for this opportunity. I'm a developmental and educational psychologist, and I'm interested in how schools can affect not just what children learn in terms of reading, writing, and mathematics, but sort of the kinds of people that they become, what we're talking about here, moral beings, happy people. And my own work has been focused on thinking about how we can't forget the adults who are parenting and teaching and leading the schools, because of course the adults create the weather for young children, the conditions for their flourishing. But what I'd like to talk to you about today is a little about the science of moral development and how it connects with, in very important ways, your own thinking about secular ethics. So what I want to do is give you a little bit of a sense of how developmental psychologists think about moral development from the very earliest stages of life all the way through old age. And so the kinds of questions that developmental psychologists ask in this regard are, do moral qualities like kindness and compassion and fairness come to us naturally through this long evolution of our mammal ancestry, or do we have to learn them? Developmentalists are also interested in, do these qualities of the moral life change over time from one stage of life to another, from infancy to childhood to adolescence and to adulthood? And we're particularly interested in trying to understand the biological.
Yes.
His Holiness is wondering whether that the young child is really he.
I know.
Time magazine comes up. But you were saying it's
they
in Time
said
magazine.
It was from Time magazine.
But Time magazine out there. Time magazine.
Do you know this? Yeah.
He has seen it before.
Oh, yes. Maybe one of my previous life.
Okay. A final issue that developmental psychologists are quite interested in is how do things change over time? What are the biological and social experiences, historical experiences, that may cause our moral life, our sense of fairness and compassion to change from age to age? And I want to just note at the beginning here that there may be additional factors at work in the lives of individuals, especially extraordinary individuals like yourself, that affect our moral development that are a bit beyond science. So I just wanted to acknowledge that here this morning. And so what I want to tell you just a little bit about is some of the exciting new findings that are coming out about what we know about moral development. Traditionally, there have been two lines of research to try to understand these kinds of questions. In the first line of research, there's been a focus on trying to understand how young children develop a sense of non-harming and a sense of fairness in their interactions with other individuals. How does that come about? And psychologists tend to think about this in terms of an ethic of justice. And the sort of developmental endpoint of that line is to learn what we call moral reversibility, this idea as instantiated in the golden rule that we should do unto others as we wish others to do unto ourselves. A second line of research in psychology traditionally has focused a bit more on the development of moral motivation. How is it that we come to empathize with and extend kindness and compassion to individuals in our lives over time? And this has been called an ethic of care, this line of research. And the upper end of that sort of development is seen as the embodiment of ahimsa, in some sense, this non-violence towards all beings, in a sense. And I just wanted to note at the outset here that I think this top line of research is very similar to what His Holiness has articulated as an ethic of restraint. How do we really learn the value of self-control and non-harming, not just because we don't want to be punished or because we're rewarded? Yes, so how do we understand that in a sense that non-harming is in our own best interest, that wise selfishness you spoke about, but also in the interest of others? And on the other hand, I think that this ethic of care is very similar to your notion of an ethic of virtue. How do we really understand that by being kind to others and giving ourselves away, we not only make other people in our lives happy, but that brings an incredible joy and satisfaction into our own life? And I think at the upper end of this developmental continuum is this idea of an ethic of altruism. You talked about this universal nature. And just three quick points I would say. I think we are learning that there are impressive moral sensibilities that are there very early at the outset of life that we inherit in some sense from evolution. But nonetheless, that it takes a long time for us to bring these intuitions about fairness and kindness into our everyday behavior. And then finally, I think the history of research on moral psychology suggests that many of us never develop a coherent moral philosophy and way of being in the world.
간다 즉 차상받지. 차상받지. 간다가 좀 맨 기만 망제려야 되게 자외 차경 요바 가실지리야 코란기 추림 그때 시를 줘라. 대 차상 보면 해보지.
More or less, we use rules of thumb and different ideas and beliefs, but we don't necessarily develop a coherent vision, which is why the work on secular ethics and educating the heart is so important, to really give people a view and a set of practices to develop along, develop the skills so that we can really embody that view in our everyday interactions with people.
So we
like to say, perhaps in developmental science, that moral development begins in our biology, but it's completed by culture and reason and our experiences with other people. And I just want to note for the audience that this set of understandings that we're coming to in science is in some ways very similar to and interconnects with your own beautiful work on secular ethics as articulated, for instance, in Ethics for the New Millennium. In that book, you talked a bit about... You talked a bit about how the human being is born with this seed of basic compassion where we extend kindness to our family and to those near and dear to us quite naturally, but that the challenge in some sense is to learn to do that same extension of kindness to those that we don't know, that are very far from us, strangers and people who have different religions or belief systems. And as you articulated it so beautifully, you said, the struggle in this regard is to overcome feelings of partiality. And I think that this is very similar to what we're learning. And so just to tell you a little, and then I'm going to show you a study, we now know that very young infants are moved by the suffering of others and wish that suffering to be alleviated. So young babies, just days after birth, will be upset by the crying of another infant, but not by a cry that's generated by a computer, and they don't even cry as much if you play back their own crying to them. So the baby seems to have an implicit sense of someone else is suffering, and they get upset by that. We also know, and we'll see this in a minute, babies prefer people who are helpful, and this makes sense because, as you said, we rely on each other for our very survival. By about the second year of life, babies prefer, if we have some resources, that it gets distributed fairly. So there's just this impressive moral inheritance that science is revealing in young children. And yet, at the same time, as you were suggesting this morning, the research also suggests that these moral, this moral inheritance that we get from biology is nonetheless biased a bit in favor of self over other and people like me versus those who seem to be not like me. And so I just want to show you a little study that Richie referred to on the first day and explore that with you through this research. If you recall, Richie played a little video and talked about how the study by Kylie Hammond and her mentors looked at how when 3 to 5 year olds watch a little puppet show, there's a puppet that's trying to get some candy or some toy out of a box, and another puppet comes and helps or harms. So I'll just play 1 minute so we can see that video.
At the ripe old age of 5 months, know the difference between right and wrong. Wesley watches as the puppet in the center struggles to open up a box with a toy inside. The puppy in the yellow shirt comes over and lends a hand. Then the scene repeats itself, but this time the puppy in the blue shirt comes and slams the box shut. Nice behavior? Mean behavior, at least to our eyes. But is that how a 5-month-old sees it? And does he have a preference?
Leslie, do you remember these guys from the show?
To find out, a researcher who doesn't know which puppet was nice and which was mean offers Wesley a choice.
Who do you like?
He can't answer, but he can reach.
And so...
His Holiness is wondering if it's not a coincidence. So it must have been repeated several times.
Yes, so many babies in the experiment, and overall what they find, I can't remember the exact number, but that 87% of all the babies they test reach for the one who's helping versus the one who's harming. So what I want to show you now is the next study that the researchers did. So this gives us a sense that infants really wish a little bit to avoid those who are antisocial, and they prefer those who are pro-social. But what happens in the next study that these same authors did was, first they asked the young child who's going to watch this puppet show to pick one of two foods, which they like more. So they can pick the food on the right or the food on the left. And then the puppets who are going to be in the show that they're going to see also pick a food. And they either pick the same food that the child likes or they pick a food that the child doesn't like. Mm. And then they watch that same slideshow one more time, a puppet show as it were. Okay? So the main character will either be someone who likes the same food or doesn't like the same food. And now these are 9-month-old and 14-month-old infants, right around 1 year of age. And here's the surprising findings, perhaps, that come out. When the child is watching the puppet that's like them, likes the same food, they prefer the helper. Hmm? But when they're watching the puppet that likes the opposite food, they prefer the one who's mean to them. And in fact, it's almost, by 14 months of age, 100% of the babies, it's about 200 babies in this study, almost all of them want to help those that are like them and want the ones who are like them to be harmed a little bit.
So His Holiness is wondering, when does the language acquisition arrive?
This is such a great, perfect question. It's starting in this first year of life and by about 18 months, but right around 14 months, we know from other research, sense of self, me, is coming, child is developing a sense of me, me-ness, right at the same moment, actually. And I just want to note that this finding is mirrored in studies of adults. Adults love people who are similar to them. We like people who look like us and dress like us. We base our friendships on that.
Then, you know, I think you have some answer. My mother have some experience when the unborn, I said, the child in her sort of womb. Hmm? Some, you see, because don't judge it. Some are very peaceful. So, is there any motivation or what factor?
Is there any motivation?
Intention on the part of the child.
I doubt it.
We
should actually ask my wife, who looks at ultrasounds of babies in the womb all the time. Susan?
Are you serious? 그걸 김행길에 그러와. 뭘 시에메로. 이제 군노다 시작하고 그랬어요.
군노 시작하고 그랬어.
시작하고 그랬어. 근데 그것 좀 시간 됐다 저도.
디두 소 용말에.
맞아 첩 첩아라 그랬다.
I think
but they have experience of discomfort and comfort.
Yes, and I think there are big individual differences in motor activity, which you can detect in the womb.
But are you suggesting it's just pure reflex?
I don't think anyone really knows.
No, but 단단 고소 시작하고 말했나?
자, 대두 소 연배가
Because this idea that the sense of self emerges only around 14 months old seems to be quite complicated because the moment a sentient creature has the ability to detect discomfort and comfort, there would be some self-reflective, notion of a boundedness of that creature.
Well, there's definitely reactivity to stimuli that may produce startle, for example. If you introduce a loud noise outside the womb, you will see a response. You can elicit a response in the fetus in the womb that can be seen on ultrasound or...
I think I would agree. The fact that the baby at 3 days old responds to the cry of another baby more than their own gives us a sense that there's a little glimmer of self very, very much earlier than psychologists used to think. And here, this idea of language-based self, that me is an object, is becoming concrete, but could be there much even earlier. This is true. So the good news about these findings suggest, and it's not a surprise because we see this in adults, that we have this bias, as we all know, towards those who are self-similar. In fact, His Holiness, in the United States, there's even evidence that people tend to marry other people with names that are similar to them. Unconsciously, this idea that we like people because they remind us of our own positive qualities. This very basic bias is there very early. But what psychology, and especially a bit later in life, we found is that this tendency to make us and them, which is very automatic, is also very malleable. We can consciously change who individuals perceive to be self-similar or different. And in some sense, changing this tendency really is a long-term developmental process where we're trying to help young children start to see other people as just like me in some sense. And so I just want to note five powerful educational tools that research has disclosed that can really help children extend this understanding of who's like me and who isn't. Because the young child is focusing on superficial aspects, different hair, a different face. But what development is trying to get them to see at a deeper level how we're similar. And in some sense, that's the journey we're all on here. And so longitudinal research in families and research in schools over and over confirms what you began by saying this morning, that a warm, affectionate adult is the foundation for moral development. If we feel safe, we feel a sense of trust in other people, and that allows us to start to internalize messages about why we should be fair and why we should be caring. And so in some sense, developmental psychology sees warmth and affection as the foundation of pro-social development. With regard to developing empathy and compassion, so much of the learning goes on visually, not just verbally, watching. You know, children are so curious watching what the adults are doing. And so, you know, It's really incumbent upon us to be good people. We know that if parents are compassionate and kind to other people, that over time, studying their children, we see that other children and teachers will rate those children also as more compassion. So they're picking up a lot without having to reason about it, just through visual cues about how to be in the world. We also know that it's really critical to have interaction with different people. In many...
Yes.
Yes. There's something called the contact hypothesis, which shows that just by interacting with people in a different country or who speak a different language, we tend to be more kind and open to and compassionate towards them. And we can do all of these things in schools. We can have pen pals. We can connect people through social media so they can see people who are diverse and different than them. Another thing we should do, American schools, I don't know about India, although I have a sense, are very competitive. We tend to rank some people as toppers and other people as not. And it turns out that's very bad for pro-social development. What we've discovered is when you give people a common goal, they can actually overcome this idea of superficial differences and connect together at a deeper level. And then finally, I think what we saw in the beautiful curricula that were presented on Tuesday is that we can teach young children and adolescents the ability to see things from a different perspective and to try to really come to appreciate that we have much more in common with each other than we sometimes have a default understanding of. And so I just want to end by showing you a little video from a school in Portland, Oregon, in the United States that I worked in. And in this school, they've organized the whole school so that they receive social-emotional learning from the time the kids are 5 till the time they're 14. And I just want you to see a little about what those children have learned about how what does it mean to take another's perspective, what does kindness feel like to them, and how does it relate to this question of flourishing in some sense that we've come here today. So I'll just show a little of their voices and then end.
You're saying things.
Perspective is kind of like making yourself see what someone else sees and feel what they feel.
Perspective is like someone, like, for example, let's say that you like hot cocoa and I don't. You have a different perspective.
Kindness is when you help somebody or you're respectful to them and you're not like fighting or being mean.
Kindness means you're sharing like your happiness with others, you're making them feel good, and I think it just feels really nice because you're making other people feel nice.
Every time I've been kind, that just makes me the happiest. Everything else has never made me as happy as that before.
Everyone is fighting a battle, you just don't know what it is always. And so you have to be like extra kind to people in case they are fighting something that's serious and it's hard to get through.
So I just want to thank you so much for this wonderful opportunity and all of the good work that's going on. I think we have a lot of things to be hopeful for if we can get this work into the world. So thank you
wonderful
so much.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions for Rob? Mm-hmm. Do you have any questions for Rob while he's here?
Questions him do I? Nothing. Not the traditional books. Your dollar go to Yan go to Slona. Jim Zish does go home. Yan go is more the dollar is more.
That is.
That Yan said, So
one thing is that we don't even need to ask children, but we know that the children prefer friends than
and
other
not only children, but experienced elders
too.
Also, you see, do you want friend or do you want enemy?
Yes.
Answer is very simple.
Yes.
Everybody is want friend, not enemy.
Yes.
Then, friend and enemy not come at the time of birth. Eventually, you see, due to certain factor,
yes.
Some people become your enemy, some people friend.
Yes.
So the main sort of factor here, show love other, you get friend. Show anger, or too much selfish.
Yes.
So this is quite simple. What did you do? So now secular, we already discussed, you mentioned, you see, the young age, you see, more sort of compassionate and warm feeling each other. Look, I think animals, birds, when the small bird, so long they need mother's care or mother. And birds' case, some birds, you see, both parents really taking care. Dog, not like that. The male dog enjoy, then disappear. So these, you see, the birds, so long the baby need others' care. Their survival depend on others' care. Then that feeling there. Once you see their
feathers, yeah, oh, ready to fly.
No?
Yes.
Then no longer that feeling. Mm-hmm. So we human beings also same. Mm. Now, from individual, because of the biological sort of factor, that's like that. Mm-hmm. When children become also the more independent, can kasoda look after themselves. Then no need others sort of kasoda
immediate care. No.
Oh, like that. So now that on that level, then educate them.
Yes.
Still we are part of humanity.
Yes.
Still we are social animal. No matter how sort of able person or physically able or mentally also very educated, but still part of the
yes.
community. So they have to, kasota, take care,
yes.
or show love. So that's through education.
Yes.
So animal, we cannot educate.
Yes.
We only human being, this brain, marvelous brain, so we can educate. Now today's reality also like that. As I mentioned earlier, so all these problems, ultimately self-centered, don't care about other side. On top of that, then weapon. I think we all have the common responsibility within this century. I think demilitarized world. Mm-hmm. We should pray that. Mm-hmm. Then eventually, de-kasota, political.
Boundaries.
That's all. This is not just sort of holy.
It's not a matter of a holy aspiration, but it's something really a necessity for the world.
Yes.
I think deep level, we are not seeking independence. Some connection is these thinking. Chinese brothers, sisters. All brothers, sisters. So we can live side by side, happily. In order to respect us. They respect us. We also certainly disrespect them. We can live side by side, happily. Sometimes I jokingly telling people, the Chinese food. I think everybody loves Chinese food, isn't it? So I think they provide us good food, delicious food. Vegetarian is concerned, I think Indian vegetarian is much better than Chinese vegetarian. Non-vegetarian food, you see, Chinese food is much better. So they should provide us good food, food for physical. We can provide them good food for mind, emotion. So,
beautiful.
It's a mutual benefit. So these also is related deep. Firstly, European Union, I already mentioned. I really sort of inspired. And then further deeper, I think these practice. Oh, we are same. They are happy, we also will be happy. One side victory, one side defeat. It's outdated, narrow-minded, short-sighted. Isn't it?
Thank you, Your Holiness. We're going to switch to...
The main point is, we have the social animals, so nature sort of basis there. Now education.
Yes.
Should sort of, because of that.
Play an active role, right? Play an active role.
To keep that basic sort of feeling of human value.
Yes.
That's why I always mentioning existing modern education is very much oriented about material value, not insight.
Inner value.
Inner value. When inner value comes, we usually see totally relying on religious faith. That not adequate. So secular education. Or secular way to educate people. These basic value of human being as a social animal, now these, till our death, we need using these things through education, through awareness. Education means?
Awareness.
Because of that. Make more awareness.
More awareness.
Like that. And then also play. I think child, I think, loves seeing some kind of the violence. Pictures.
Like the video games.
Excited.
Because it's tense and quite exciting.
Yes.
Sometime back, I think more than 20 years ago, one occasion, one company selling toys
yeah.
or something or for children. They, I think around Christmas or something, you see, they decided short period, I think 1 month or 2 months, they will not produce these small play. Because of the,
Video games, violent games.
So nowadays, through education, I think all part of society, you see, should develop common aim, common goal. Then the people, you see, who produce these sort of, including these missions, they also, you see, carry sense of that responsibility. And then politicians, and businessmen, or scientists, especially brain scientists. Really?
Yes.
Now, the time come, I think we, in different profession field, I think, still human being, so should have the common responsibility, universal responsibility, and from all parts, making effort through their own profession, same goal. Then, I think, within this century, world can be something different.
Different.
Now, instead of praying, one time, I think some of you already know, a few years ago, Bihar State, the chief minister very sort of, I think, they're very much sort of interested about Buddha Dharma. So in his own, the state capital, he built one a Buddhist temple, one Buddhist image also, Buddhist statue also. So he invited me. And then in his sort of speech, he mentioned, due to Buddha's blessing, his state more
prosperity.
Then my turn, talk. If your state become more prosperity due to Buddha's blessing, then over 1,000 years ago, your state must be prosperity.
Very, very prosperous.
Because of Buddha's blessing, already there. So now, Buddha's blessing must depend on able chief minister's action or hand. That's right now. Now that's the case. A peace, pray peace, Buddha, to God or Muhammad. At puja, puja, puja. I don't believe in puja. Of course, individual practice, good. But for whole society, whole world, I don't think puja can help. I don't think. This is a waste of time. Sorry.
So, thank you, Rob.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Really.
Matthew and I were talking about a difficult problem in this area, Your Holiness, which is that even though people may know the virtue like compassion, or we may teach it, people may not act that way actually when they have the opportunity. That you can say, I believe in compassion, but when the opportunity comes to actually show it, it doesn't always come. So Matthew is going to deal with these problems.
So, Your Holiness, as always, when I'm asked by my friend to speak in your presence, I feel like lighting a match in bright daylight. Quite useless, but for the sake of our brothers and sisters, a few things. And then also, there's a few interesting ideas that, you know, when we speak of ethics, what happens here? If we don't base it on compassion, then very often it doesn't lead to actual ethical behavior. There are extreme cases of people preaching all life long moral issues, and then you find sometimes they do terrible things on the back scene. So I just begin with a few examples to come through psychology and science, and then at the request of our friends, maybe say how through secular ideas based on sort of Buddhist thinking, what is the reason and the process to develop this ethics based on compassion. So first of all, ethics does need compassion. So here are a few examples of what happens of having a strong moral sense, being able to know what is good and bad, but being sort of have a very weak compassion. There's a study that has been being done in schools. You know, bullying is very often in school. So there was a study done with more than 700 children. So among those, there are some who do bully others, as you can see here, the victim, and some who come to help, to protect the child. So interestingly, when you ask and you interview those who bully, they actually know very well. They're capable of a high level of moral reasoning. This is wrong, this is right. They don't lack that. Actually, they have the same level of advanced moral reasoning that the people who help.
Namie je tukis.
So they know what is right and wrong. But the difference is if we trying to estimate or evaluate their level of care and compassion, they are very weak on compassion, while the defenders show more stronger compassion. But they know what is right and wrong. So that's why it seems that just knowing is not enough. There's another study that sometimes we say we should be fair with others. And this motivation can lead us to be fair. So what happens when we base mostly our relation to others on fairness, justice, and not compassion? If someone does something unfair to us, the study that was done with Tanya Singer, you know, she's often Wolf's daughter, showed that people who think that fairness is the main motivation for ethical behavior, when they are treated unfairly, they basically mostly become angry and wish to take revenge, because everything is based on this is unjust, this is unfair, and I get upset with that, and sometimes I try to retaliate. Or they think that I should behave nicely or fairly to others because I fear to be punished if I don't do that. So when it's all based on this concept of fairness, that's not enough. But she could show that the people who are based their motivation on compassion, then their main wish is that other person's well-being. So therefore, compassion should imbue ethics with this wish of caring for others. So now, how do we sort of bring about? So first of all, that is why a compassionate ethic is not about declaring this is good, this is bad, in absolute sense. No matter what, whichever the context is in human situation, this is always bad and this is always good. So it's about the good and the bad effect that our thoughts, our attitudes, our words, our actions will have on the happiness and suffering of others. So that's how we could say this is an undesirable action or a desirable one. So therefore, if we want ethics, we need to ponder the short and the long-term effect or impact or consequences of our action on others' well-being. So that's basically at the heart, not just declaring this is good, declaring this is bad, and that's it. So now, what is the process for us? And here we draw on the Buddhist reasoning on that, to start to grow a compassionate ethic. So it has to begin with recognizing that deep within ourselves, we have this deep aspiration to avoid suffering and achieve happiness. So if we don't recognize that, how can we identify in others? And so then the second time is I have to value that. This is important. The fact that I don't want to suffer and that no one wakes up in the morning thinking may I suffer the whole day, this is something that matters to me. And then I have to be concerned with accomplishing that, not just wishing to be happy or not to suffer, and do just the opposite. In Buddhism, we say, you can't keep your hand in the fire and wish not to be burned. So you have to know what you accomplish to fulfill that aspiration. So that means I need to understand the law of causality and distinguish what should be done and what should be avoided if I don't want to suffer. So now that seems pretty straightforward, but it may be not easy. Because unless we have some wisdom, not just to find out the superficial way of being happy by looking for fame, power, money, and so forth, and turn, as Shantideva said, we want happiness, but we turn our back to happiness, we don't want to suffer, but we run toward the cause of suffering, kind of addicted to the cause of suffering. So we need wisdom about the fundamental causes of suffering, which is, as you mentioned, distortion of reality, delusion, and we project endlessly our own sort of self-fabrication, and the basic ignorance, which is not to recognize the way things are, save our common humanity, our common sentience, and so forth. So without wisdom, it would be very difficult to understand the heart of the law of cause and effect. So now, then what is ethics now? Ethics, or compassionate ethics,
consists to apply exactly the same reasoning, but toward others. It's not very difficult to imagine that deep within anyone's mind, even though they are deluded, they don't know how to achieve happiness, but deep within, they don't want to suffer. And therefore, just as I don't want to suffer, neither do any other sentient being. It's not a single one. So therefore, I should value that. And one of the main key ingredients of altruism is valuing others. When there is a genocide, you see a devaluation of others. You treat them as rats, as vermin, as pests. The world will be better without them. So you dehumanize sentient beings at the level of animals. And often we de-animalize animals at the level of objects so that we devalue others. So to value others' aspiration to avoid suffering is a key point. Then we should be concerned. We should see what is the situation of others. Are they well? Do they suffer? So that's a key ingredient that we apply to ourselves, and now we're applying it to others. So we need to analyze the impact of my own actions on the well-being and suffering of others, not just taking as a wish. So for this, we need to cultivate, not just what, as you mentioned, Rob mentioned, has been given us by evolution as the basic faculty to care for those who are dear to us, which comes naturally, but to cultivate through envisioning others, enlarging the circle of altruism, compassion, and wisdom. Otherwise, it remains very narrow-minded, and it's very difficult to embrace all sentient beings within that wish. So in that sense, ethics is not just a set of rules. It's embedded in a much larger worldview and a path of transformation from ignorance to wisdom, from excessive self-centeredness to compassion, basically wishing good to every single being without exception. Why should we not, from the start, sort of limit that? Now, some definition might be useful. Now, altruism or benevolence or warm-heartedness is the wish that may others find happiness and the cause of happiness. And in Buddhism especially, the cause of happiness is very important because it's not simply the obvious causes, but going at the heart of wisdom or ignorance. So when beings suffer, then that altruistic wish becomes or transforms when it's confronted with suffering. It becomes the wish, may others be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. Now, wisdom, in order to enact altruism and compassion, is basically knowing reality as it is. There's no more gap between the way things appear and the way things are, whether it's interdependence, impermanence, notion of self and others, and so forth. Now, when we speak of compassion, mostly we think of affective, you feel compassion. And that is true. Affective compassion is to become aware of the suffering of beings, and we feel almost unbearable feeling when we see the magnitude of the suffering of beings. We cannot stand anymore that those suffering continue. So then we generate the strong and courageous determination to alleviate this suffering. So that is the basic of feeling the suffering with them and deciding that we were going to do something about it. But there's also a cognitive aspect to compassion that's not often emphasized to the same extent. It's to analyze the causes of suffering. And it's not just, whether people have a toothache or obvious suffering. There's also the suffering, as we know in Buddhism, links with the impermanence and with the most basic one, which is basic ignorance, which distorts reality. So if you think that most beings, in fact, suffer because of this ignorance, this is not an emotion, this is a wisdom understanding, and this is not always sort of clear when we speak in common language of compassion. We must think of the level of feeling. So those two, the affective side and the wisdom side, needs to go together. So now there's another element, which is empathy. If I don't resonate with the suffering of others or the joy of others, when they smile, then others smile, When something feels joyful, we feel joyful. So we resonate with each other. Those are two very old people in one of our elderly home in Tibet. So, but also...
So
I was saying that the guy on the left has all his teeth intact. So it was almost as if he's showing them off.
I'm not sure they are real teeth. So, but the problem...
Beautiful, really beautiful.
Yes, sir. If we resonate with suffering, what happens very often, and it affects the resonating with suffering leads to the impact the suffering of others has on us. It is the effect it has on us. So the more suffering, it becomes like we are overwhelmed. And there have been studies showing that 60% of all medical caregivers in the United States are or will suffer of burnout, emotional exhaustion. And I was recently in Singapore at the University of Medicine, and they said they did a study, 80% of doctors, nurses, caregivers, social workers suffer of burnout. So then they say, oh, you should distance yourself so that you don't burn out. But that's not the right way. So the right way is warm-heartedness, altruistic love, compassion. And this is not just an idea. We work with Tanya Singer, and she could show that the empathic resonance with suffering that is affecting me is different in the brain, different network, than compassion that is geared towards others. And those are different network. And in fact, that if we train caregivers in compassion, it is an antidote to the empathic distress or burnout. It gives them strength. And the more suffering, the more courage. If it's empathic suffering, distress, the more suffering, the more you, it's like a burden. So this is something essential when we want to help caregivers, because medical students, they are told all kinds of things. They are told to be tough, that they have to stay 24 hours, you know, without sleeping to care for the patient. But there's hardly any mention about teaching loving kindness, compassion, which of course are necessary. So now, why just purely moral reasoning is not enough without compassion? This is important for two things, for instance, two examples, future generation and other species, animals. So why? Many philosophers, and we had this when we did the Mind and Life meeting on environment, said that future generations have no rights. The notion of right is based on an individual that exists, that can claim their right. I have right to be not bullied and so forth. So human rights is based on people who exist, who can be aware of their rights, and also they need to reciprocate. They say if you don't reciprocate, I mean you respect others' right, notion of human right cannot apply. So from that perspective, then future generation, they don't exist, they can claim their right, and they cannot reciprocate. But yet, we know that they will exist. And so the idea, if you have a compassionate ethics, is they have the natural right not to suffer. Because they will exist, they say, you know what you did, and yet you didn't do anything to prevent our suffering. So since we know it is 100% certain that there will be billions and billions of human beings and they will suffer of today's action. So their rights, the most fundamental rights of ethical compassion is the right not to suffer. It is immoral and unjust to inflict unnecessary suffering to others. The same thing is argued for other species. Many philosophers say animals cannot have rights because they don't know about the rights and they cannot reciprocate. But again, it's the same thing. they have rights not to suffer. Recently, I looked in the numbers. Since Homo sapiens appeared on Earth, they estimate at about 100 billion human beings have existed, because 10,000 years ago, there was only 5 million of us. 100 billion. That is the number of animals we kill every 2 months. We kill 6 million animals every hour. Terrestrial animal, 60 billion every year. Sea animal, 1,000 billion. As if nothing happened. It's just no issue. So there's a huge ethical gap. So that's why, without compassion, ethics will not work. So now, since this week is also dedicated to parenting education, I just look at some study who stress, by looking at many studies, 4 parental attitudes that favor altruistic behavior in children. We know, for instance, that if parents themselves are generous, they help others, the children are more likely to do so. If parents are very selfish and never do anything for others, these children are likely to do so. This has been studied. But there are 4 parental attitudes that seems to always favor behavior in children. Mm-hmm. Expressing affection, acting in an altruistic way oneself, thereby serving others as an example for the children, making children aware of the impact of their action rather than punishment and reward. This is bad, I punish you. This is good, here is a sweet. It doesn't work. There's a study of 10 years old children that were asked to spend time in hospital with other children dying of cancer. To some children, after they give some sweets and rewards, some not. After 2 weeks, they ask the children, are you ready to go back to help those children in the hospital? Those who are rewarded, most of them say no, because they don't want to go just for a sweet. But those who did that out of good heart, most of them were ready to go again. So it's better to inspire to intrinsic value, enhance the compassionate nature than the just giving rewards. And then providing children with the opportunity to be useful to others. So now, very often in secular schools, we say education has to be neutral. We should not say, children, you should be compassionate. And there was a worldwide study with 100,000 people from 15 to 25 years old. Do you think that there are universal values? Less than half said there are universal values. And I thought, because they thought, say, you take children, people in Pakistan, they say, oh, we are going to impose Western values. But I think if you're asking, is warm-heartedness a universal value? Is forgiveness a universal value? Is trustworthiness a universal value? They will agree. So the idea that education should be neutral doesn't work, because children will acquire value anyway, and usually to computer games, not the right ones. So there is a school, group of school in England, it's now about 10% of all school, who have an education on, it's called value-based education. And every week, the teacher with the children choose one value, like respect, benevolence, responsibility. They write it over the walls, and they try throughout the study of the week to speak about that and relate that to the subject that they have been studying. Not just an extra, but embedded in every day. And this has been evaluated in Australia on 100,000 children, and it has given remarkable results. And I cannot detail those here.
Value area finished. Mix it. Set in chair. That the lab shall do. Australia, the world captain with the chair is finished.
So, in that sense, since the children won't be neutral anyway, why not give the right values in a secular way? I mean, nothing of that has to do with religion, gratitude, humility, hope. So, why? And another thing is the, it was mentioned many times, is the cooperative learning. You see, the competitive learning you know, not everybody can be in the first five if you have 40 children. So it gives a very sort of competitive, sort of not good feeling atmosphere. There have been many attempts to emphasize cooperative learning. Put children by a group of five or six, put it a good student with less good student helping each other, and that gives remarkable results. So again, I cannot go into details, but there have been many attempts to do that. It gives a better atmosphere, more less conflict, better relation with the teachers, and do children learn better. So all this seems to be common sense if you want to bring a more compassionate world. So the thing is, and that's of course the quote that you love, so this, as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, until then, may I too remain to dispel the misery of the world. So I think if we think of compassion, we should not think it's sort of good feeling idea that we can afford altruism when everything goes well as a luxury. It seems that, you know, to address the main challenges of our time, which is to take care of the short-term poverty, finance, economic situation, the mid-term, the quality of life, the happiness over a lifetime, and now the long-term of the fate of future generation. Selfishness cannot do the job. If I don't care for what happens in 100 years, there's no environment problem. We won't be there to have the suffering. It's only if we have more consideration for others than people who work, scientists on environment, policymakers, economists, social workers, can sit at the table to build together a better world. And I love the concept of the banality of goodness. That means most of the time, most of 7 billion beings behave decently to each other. And that's why we are so shocked when there are barbaric acts and things like that that immediately in the news, but we forget that basic goodness is much more there. We are not going to congratulate ourselves when we come out that nobody had a fight in this room, because that's what basic goodness is about. Thank you so much.
Wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you. Matthew, thank you for that beautiful presentation. And you brought us to tea time. This is a very good day to have some hot tea, or at least hot water, for tea break.
So thank you very much again for the opportunity to speak with you today. I am going to speak today about two separate areas of research that are linked. The first one is the experimental study of the effects of brief training in compassion. And the second area is a different kind of research that we haven't talked about as much, but it's called community-based research, where we work collaboratively with teachers and parents to understand the implications of compassion practice for the adults who support children. And I want to say just at the outset... I want to take a moment to just say at the outset that the work I'll be sharing with you is really the work of many wonderful people, and to just acknowledge my gratitude to the teams of people with whom I work.
Roshisa.
Yes. She will appear again. We will see. And then also the team of people who inspire and support our work in education. It's a very large and wonderful group. So I want to begin with this scientific study that we did on compassion training. And this area of research is still very much in the stage of infancy. But growing rapidly. Our interest was to contribute to this foundation by doing a study on understanding just the impact of a brief compassion training. And we wanted to focus on a training that we could standardize, so we knew that everyone in the study would receive the same training. and that would be widely accessible to people and that they could integrate into their daily lives. And we thought, what tool will help us to do that? And we realized the one thing that most people have with them all the time is their phone. And so we recorded a series of practices that people could listen to on their phones every day. So that was the nature of the training in this study. And we also wanted to quantify.
So what kind of guided practices they did?
I will show you in detail in one moment, if that's okay. We also wanted to quantify compassionate behavior in a way that we could study in the lab. And so what we did was we quantified that as financial donations to suffering others. So we asked participants to come into the lab and see photos and hear stories of people who were suffering, like children who had no homes or children who had very severe physical illnesses. And to answer questions, we asked them, how do you feel about this child? And what do you think about them? And then we gave them $100 and we offered them the opportunity to keep the money or to share the money, which we actually donated to the charities that helped the children. And then some of the participants were assigned randomly to receive this training. Now, this was a complicated study, and it had multiple conditions, but I'm going to just talk today about two.
Are you going to say with the compassion training?
Yeah. This was the nature of the compassion training that they received here on the slide. And you see again your friend Roshi Joan Halifax, who was the person who wrote the training and who recorded it. And it was her voice that participants listened to every day on the phone. The compassion training was four different practices that they were asked to listen to every day for across 4 weeks. So that the practices involved feeling the suffering for another, perspective taking of the other, imagery and visualization. Participants were asked to practice 20 minutes every day. And they did this about 75% of the days over the 4 weeks.
So the recording itself is 20 minutes long?
Yes, exactly.
So, 4 weeks.
Okay. So in addition to listening to the recording, each day they also heard the true story of one of the suffering people. And they looked at their picture on the phone as part of their practice. These were the people in the compassion training group. Now the control group, all they did each day was they were asked to listen to the story and see the picture of the suffering other. But they received no training and no tools in what to do with that information.
The research jebache se de tumbu nyil da tumbu chili ya ni ji me ba me nam gong ye da lab ta ko de dar re na ka ma ni shi ni ma re na ka ma ni shi nyen de gor wa ta te te da nyam bo le ya ni dung ye ge nyam nyong ye de ni ge bu gu dun de ge de ye che ta tsuna ngo ta grup ni ba de le ya ni ji me ba gong ye da ma la ba che ta ku ju de ka ngai che ge ni ju de ge de xian ji bo shi ma de ya ma sa ko ye.
So what did we find? I'd like to share with you just a few of the results from this study. What you see here, first, are the change in donations that were made from the beginning, before the training period, to the end. And you see the compassion training group depicted in red, and the control that we're just repeatedly exposed to the stories and images of suffering others in the gray. And we see in the study no significant change over time in donation among the compassion participants, but we see a significant drop in the donation among the people who were repeatedly exposed to the suffering others without any training.
네 개발 지역에서 닝지 검 마진에서 제바다에 슉충을 쉬고 있었어. 동해 동해 전야 삼단 되니.
Just for out of curiosity, what were they told?
What were they told?
Yeah, I mean the study.
Yes, they were told that this was a study about learning about people's responses to the stories that they were provided. Yeah. We think that these results may suggest that these control participants may have habituated to the suffering of others, leading to a decrease in their behavioral response, and that one of the potential impacts of the compassion training is that it buffered against this diminishment over time.
Could you explain habituation?
Yeah, so that when you see the same stimulus again and again, that you have a lower response to that.
You
kind of get numb.
And I'll explain why we think that the compassion helped to buffer against this. When we look at, as Matila was talking about, these two components of compassion, the cognitive and the affective, we also asked participants to answer questions along these dimensions. Here we see the changes when we asked people, how similar do you think you are to this person's status in society? And we see that the people who learned the compassion practice over time, they saw themselves as more similar. And then we asked them, how similar do you think your values are to the values of this suffering person? And over time, we also saw that the people who practiced the compassion saw their values as more similar at the end of the study. In contrast, the people who just received the no training at all had no change in their perception of similarity in status and value. In addition, we asked them about their emotions or their affective response, and this is, I think, very interesting, this pattern of findings. What we saw was that the people who did the compassion practice had an increase in their feelings of tenderness. And we think that this experience of tenderness is very much what you describe in that warm-heartedness towards others. So over time, they experience greater warm-heartedness. In contrast, the people in the control condition had no change in tenderness. When we looked at their experience of distress when watching the images and hearing the stories, the compassion group did not increase in distress or decrease, but the control group actually had lower distress over time, which we think may be indicative of a kind of blunted response or even a kind of numbing to people's stories of suffering. The kind of process that I think Tanya Singer and Matila have talked about as a kind of fatigue that can develop over time when people are exposed again and again to the suffering others without being given tools for knowing how to respond to that. Now, so in as I said, this is one small study of a very brief training. But I think that it does give us some important clues that compassion training can impact how we think about, how we mentalize or attribute about other people, and also our emotional response to others. And it tells us that there may be some danger, some harm in not providing this training to other people, both in terms of their generosity and their experience of feeling for the suffering of others. What I'd like to do now is just turn very briefly to what we see as some potential implications of these data for the field of education. We worked this past year for many months with teachers, hand in hand.
So
in terms of this, these kind of responses, has ever a study been done on average individuals, how they respond to the suffering of others, like someone who's close to that person, someone who's a total stranger, someone whom the person doesn't like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we, in a normal setting, the responses are different. But has this kind of study done?
Where you're testing the effect on... well, in this study, actually, it doesn't answer that question exactly, but there's a little clue, I think. In the 4 weeks when they were practicing, we showed them images of, we had 24 stories of people who were suffering. And when during those 4 weeks, we showed them half of those people. So at the end, they were exposed to some new stories, and there weren't differences in how they responded to those two. It's a little bit, but I think you raise a great question about what, if we were to look at people to whom they were naturally close.
Perhaps, does anybody else know of any such studies? As Owen has asked, if there was a study of how this would affect your attitude towards someone you felt was like you, is that right? Neutral and dislike. Yeah. Hold the mic.
There have been some studies using some physiological measures of empathy showing that you have a stronger physiological resonance with a person who is more similar.
Mm-hmm.
So that finding is quite quite robust in the study. In the scientific literature.
And you can also do the W button, so there's empathetic. Empathetic response. So the point is, all in this is trying to make is that we need to somehow find a way to distinguish between attachment.
Yeah.
To someone whom you like versus compassion for that person.
Mm-hmm.
Because a genuine compassion is independent of attachment.
Genuine compassion can extend towards your enemy. Attachment, biased.
Biased, yeah.
Hold the mic up.
Yes. About the bias, in a study, you know, the football, they're very strong attachment to their side on other side. So they put in the street someone who was in difficulty wearing the shirt of one side football. And they watch who was going to help. 90% as those who support the same football club. Those who support the other ones, they just pass.
So this is a little bit different because this is kind of contextual, because your sense of identity of belonging to this particular group is heightened. So in that situation, your response will indicate that. Mm-hmm. His Holiness was saying that something like that happens also in the debating courtyard, you know, depending on which monastery you are from. So there's a kind of a side taking that goes on. So this is not really attachment versus anger, aversion we are talking about.
One of the things that we hope will come from this meeting is ways that we can improve our science and our scientific study of these questions. And I think your question you're raising is very helpful, because we can incorporate that into future studies to ask people to focus perhaps on people to whom they're attached, people to whom are neutral strangers, and perhaps even people to whom they have personal aversion or dislike. So that is a study that I think we could do in repeating this with those. It's very helpful.
Take the mic.
Hello, yes. There have been two studies also about this. One is about people who give their kidney to unknown persons. Mm-hmm. There's about 200-300 every year in the United States. And there's a psychologist who studied that. And they all say, the reason I do that, if you ask you, would you give a kidney to your mother? Many people said yes. So why stopping there? And they all say, because I feel the common humanity, why should that make a difference between my mother and them? So this group of people spontaneously speak of common humanity. And same thing about those who rescued Jewish people in the Second World War. Hundreds have been studied.
Yes.
There were some very rich people, some very poor people. The main thing is not about religion, wealth, it's about sense of common humanity. That was the factor that was common to all of them. So extending the circle of feeling we are brothers and sisters.
I would like to turn our attention just briefly with a couple of points to the implications that these conversations have for education. As we develop this course that we taught last year with teachers that was focused in part on love and compassion in teaching, we shared with them lots of scientific studies. And one of the ones that touched them very deeply was actually this graph that you see on the screen here about the distress. Because when they looked at that, they had a moment of awareness that this is what it is like for many of us as teachers in working with students, particularly students who have a lot of stress and adversity in their lives. They shared with us that we are presented again and again every day with the hardship and the suffering of our students and their family. And we're giving so many tools for how to teach reading and how to teach math, but we're not given tools for how to respond to the suffering of our students and their families.
Dil Gigenzo, Lamsalol, Babachonsons, as a good Nirinirin, Lonsen, Lolia, Puma, which was Ganga, but the Yetiganizu, Shinshin Barbas, the Jagaton and Kuranzole stress you had that same day you had at the Jagger Ganga Tail, but the Kuranzan Yamnoton shared to us.
This is an image that shows that process, and what one of the educators said. She reported her belief that these practices and her experience are essential for all educators, all students, and for all human beings. She said making this available, even required, for all educators could have great impact and in ways we may not yet imagine. So the teachers are hungry for this kind of training. We also do a lot of work with families who are immigrants to the United States, in particular immigrants from Mexico, El Salvador, Guatemala, and neighboring countries. And those families have, and their children have faced enormous pressure in our country, particularly this last year. And because their voices are often silent or kept to the side in school systems, we wanted to understand from their eyes, how do they see compassion in their schools and in their families? And so we gave them, we met with them for many months, and we gave them cameras. And we asked them, please go into your life and take pictures of compassion and come back and share them with us. And I'll end with just one image from one of the families, one of the mothers. And these were all mothers with students who were about 5 to 10 years old. And she brought back this image of children in the play yard, and she said, this is what we believe about compassion, that we carried love with us from childhood, and we share our feelings of this, no matter our age, no matter our color. To live with compassion in our world is the most important thing. What can we do? So they also, like the teachers, are asking for practices to help support that in recognizing its importance. And finally, I'll just say that I think that what we have learned from the teachers and the parents is very consistent with the notion that love and compassion truly are necessities, and perhaps now more than ever more in our world where there's so much divisiveness and fragmentation. So I thank you very much.
Thank you. I want to ask the on brain, the chaksum gzawata, chaksum mebe zawati, lebetan yochitur.
So, from the brain point of view, would you say it is conceivable to see a difference between a love that comes with an attachment and love that comes without attachment?
Yes, I think very definitely. One of the ways that we have studied attachment is a quality that, for lack of a better term, we have called stickiness, where there is literally an inability to let go of something, an object toward which there is some kind of positive feeling. And we can measure that, and it seems to be embodied in connections among different brain circuits. So it's not one place or another. This is similar to a point that Amishi made the other day, but it is in the connections among brain regions that attachment seems to arise or seems to be correlated with. And so when there is love with attachment compared to love without attachment, we could see those differences in these patterns of connectivity in the brain.
When there's
love with attachment, one of the important distinctions that neuroscientists have made is between wanting and liking. And when there is attachment, the wanting circuitry is present. And so when the object of attachment is no longer present, there's still the wanting, and we can measure that.
Deba, no. Tanto kuzo, sari betone,
Thank you.
So we're making little bits of progress, Your Holiness.
Richie, have you begun to study or thought of studying how to change that, how to help people move from a love with attachment to a more universal?
I mean, I think this is really the issue of ignorance and delusion. And so being able to deeply understand the nature of impermanence is something that can be very helpful with attachment. And so what we see is that in practitioners who have cultivated a deep appreciation for impermanence, they show considerably less evidence of this kind of stickiness, where we can measure these qualities of attachment in the brain.
그래서
So at some point we will need to look at some quantum physicist who genuinely look at the world from the point of view of their quantum physics to see what their brain looks like.
Yeah, you know, I Mathieu and I were talking about this yesterday, and it's really an interesting suggestion, Your Holiness. And I wonder, many people have intellectual beliefs about the value of certain qualities in the world, such as the value of impermanence or of love and compassion, but it is knowledge that we would call in neuroscience declarative. It's a concept, but it's not necessarily embodied. And we can distinguish that with procedural knowledge, which requires practice and is more embodied knowledge. And so it would be of great interest to know whether quantum physicists actually have embodied knowledge of the entities concepts that they're studying in physics, or whether they just regard this as properties of the quantum world, but not necessarily applicable to everyday life.
So, of course, here, you know, we were talking about three levels of understanding, just verbal and listening, and then, you know, second level where you gain a conviction through critical reflection. So if someone has done the second level processing, then one would expect some impact. Because a lot of us have knowledge at the level of the at the first level. For example, most Tibetans chant on a daily basis, may all sentient beings be free from suffering, may all sentient beings be happy, and they chant hundreds of thousands of times.
There's a great quantum physicist here, so maybe our scientist friend can test him this afternoon and report tomorrow morning to Your Holiness.
Go ahead.
I wanted to ask a question, if I might. all of our studies that we do, all they rely on people to volunteer to participate in our studies. And so already the people who come to our research and that we report in all the behavioral and neuroimaging studies, people already, by virtue of volunteering, have some seed of altruism.
Yes.
What we want, I think, collectively, is to reach all people, is to even the people who may see things very differently and may be contributing to the divisiveness in our world right now. So, and one of the very first steps that in Mathieu Law's presentation was about valuing this. And so I was wondering if you might share with us any thoughts about how we could begin to address that everybody, even the people who don't have this seed of altruism within them.
Our research for as a humanity, not selected people or believer. So maybe worthwhile non-believer. Among the believer, like genuine Sorovars Day practitioner of theistic religion, I think their philosophy, their concept very powerful. We all created by God, and God, like our Father, the nature of God is infinite love. So we, 7 million human beings, are children of that kind of Father.
Force them.
So that also very, very powerful to develop a genuine sense of brotherhood, sisterhood, and respect to other. All 7 billion are truly our brothers, sisters. Wonderful. Number of occasions I met some Christian practitioner. When they explain these things, and also with some prayer, with the music towards God, dear. And their exclusive behavior, also like that. And the late Thomas Merton, the one of them, wonderful. So, non-believer, I think, can represent humanity generally. Maybe worthwhile
to study.
Even, I think, furthermore, people who really feel religion is bad. Human nature,
so even if we include people who have very anti-religious views, if we can study them. One thing I want to add is that this is where His Holiness's approach for promotion of compassion is so powerful, because what he is doing is to really appeal to the person's impulse for pursuit of self-interest. Because he's making the case that compassion is good for you. The first beneficiary of a compassion act is yourself. You know, whether that act really, or whether that act or feeling actually benefits the object of your compassion depends on many other factors. You know, sometimes you extend the hand, the person may not take it. But on your part, you have already experienced that expansiveness and openness. Mm-hmm. I think making those case, you know, I mean, it seems almost paradoxical that you're making a case for other-centered, you know, attitude from a self-centered kind of argument. But in the end, I think that is something that, because a lot of people who consciously reject the value of compassion probably don't realize that it is in fact good for themselves. And for many people, His Holiness's
you know, written in the book, that sometimes people tend to associate values like compassion with religion. And if they're not interested in religion, then they also ignore these values. So to disentangle values like compassion and kindness from religious framework and to turn grounded in basic human nature and their own pursuit of well-being, I think that if we can find a way to develop that language, that discourse, and find a way to, you know, support it by science, I think that probably will be, then we can reach everybody.
In a way, that means like altruism is a win-win situation.
So His Holiness is wondering, because in Buddhist thought, there is this understanding that sometimes a compassion can motivate kind of a sense of outrage, which is a wrathful mental attitude. So at that moment, even though you are relating to this person in an angry manner, but the ultimate motivation behind this is a compassion. So would it make sense from a brain point of view that something like these two... So in this case, such a compassion would be completely independent of attachment. There is no doubt. But the question he's asking is, would it make sense from the brain perspective to have two such diametrically opposed attitudes present at the same time in this person's mind?
Being compassionate and being wrathful. One of the insights that we've gleaned from dialogues with Your Holiness in the past have actually been around the topic of anger. And one of the insights I think that's emerged is that anger often arises when our goals are being thwarted. And the original impulse for anger may be an energetic response that evolution has equipped us with to overcome obstacles, but it's not necessarily destructive. It does not necessarily involve any kind of harm or violence. It's simply an energetic and focused response. And so wrathful in that sense, I think, can be very helpful and is not necessarily inconsistent with compassion. And Your Holiness, if I can, I wanted to just ask another question. You used the term selfishness earlier as a root cause of much of many problems that we have in our world today. And we can think of selfishness in many ways like an illness, like malaria or Ebola. And the previous Surgeon General of the United States, Vivek Murthy, who was appointed by Obama, is a wonderful man. And one of the central platforms of his tenure as Surgeon General, which is the chief public health officer of the United States, was that well-being is an urgent public health need. I wonder what Your Holiness might think of the eradication of selfishness as an urgent public health need, and whether Your Holiness would participate and help to organize a worldwide campaign to eradicate selfishness.
Vaccination. I know yesterday I mentioned why selfish.
So His Holiness is not really advocating total elimination of selfishness, because he spoke about wise selfish. Because, you know, that
foolish selfish, truly troublemaker. Wise selfish, very good, bring together.
So eradicate foolish selfish.
Foolish selfish.
Oh, that thing, foolish selfish. Selfish.
Let it. So but we can call it narrow-minded selfishness. Foolish selfish.
Did it? Yes.
There are a few other people here. We have a queue, actually. Rob, Tish. Rob, you're next. And Sona, and then go, since you grabbed the mic.
So instead of eradicating selfishness, in our school we talk about selffulness, which is, in our model, the one that is connected to the whole. So maybe that could be useful.
Self-fullness.
Self-fullness is when we come with compassion for ourselves and we're able to extend to others and then to the us domain.
So the main point is to agree on what is it that needs to be promoted, and then that people may have different, you know, way of phrasing it, but that could be settled.
Oh, different philosophy. Some say God, creator, wonderful. Some say no God, no creator, but rather self-creation. That also very good. Same goal, yeah.
Rob.
I was just wondering, we were talking...
He is mic'd.
Yeah, he's mic'd.
Yes. Can you hear me now?
Just raise your hand.
Oh, sorry. Yes, hello. Hello. Good. I was wondering, we were talking a bit about self earlier.
You're not switched on, actually.
Like this? I'll just try this one.
Can you tell the number? You have a number on your... Oh, yeah, that's better.
No, both.
Oh, we got both, maybe.
No, you're good.
So we've talked about basic goodness, and we've talked about ignorance as a root cause of suffering, and we talked a little about self. I'm wondering if there's a sense of how self arises in the young child, in the tradition of the Buddhist psychological tradition. Is there any insights into this?
Any good sense of self So the understanding in Buddhism is to make a distinction between a kind of a natural embodied sense of self, which has no real
thought content. There's no cognitive role in it. It's a sense of existence. So for example, one would expect the moment the fetus begins to experience pain and discomfort and pleasure, one would expect there to be some kind of sense of self. It's not declarative and it's not cognitive, but it's almost like a kind of a basic sense of existence, basic sense of being. And then
I think the mosquito also have that feeling. Without that, no movement.
So this
sucking blood.
So this is expected to be present.
Yeah. No, there is a sense of I, me, like that.
So this sense of self one would expect across all species. There's even a text that says that the sense of self is so basic and innate that it exists in all beings, all sentient beings. And it's not something that they learn, but it's something that they are born with. But then, of course, there's another kind of sense of self, which is language-based, and that arises only when there is the thought, you know, becomes more active. So it's a language-based. Then that's an internalized notion of a self. So that comes later. And then philosophers would even go further and then develop a whole concept of self and, you know, attribute notions of permanence, eternity, unity, and so on. So that's the theory of self.
So when we talk about selfless altruism...
Mike, please.
Just to follow up, so when we talk about selfless altruism, it's really that objectified sense of me versus other, rather than the distinction of my body from the external world in some sense that we're speaking about?
That's true.
It doesn't secret at all, and the easy sick, but a selfless sorrow, chick chick citizen, eh? Under the mute self saddy, chick chick, the lot on the condor, easy sick.
Larry.
Yanko, the Tada Lejas signal, the Tada do you the military? Yanko,
Larry.
Go Kanta Minsi di Go Kasore. Kumshi cultural heritage on the only world.
Larry.
Chazanga. Western cultures level, you know, English also, the Western cultures level, you know, due to Christian background.
Narin.
Just a language, the dish,
So, one thing that we do need to take into account when we are talking about terms like self, selflessness, and so on, the importance of the culture influence. Because, you know, self is an English term which is part of the Judeo-Christian cultural heritage. So many of the English terms have connotations that are rooted in, you know, thousands of years cultural history. So when we use it to translate some other term from outside other culture, like Sanskrit or Tibetan or Buddhist, then, you know, we can't expect there to be exact one-to-one correlation. So that's something that we have to keep in mind so that we don't, you know, completely ignore the cultural influence on the terminology. So, otherwise, you know, it becomes difficult to appreciate the insight that is being offered in, say, Buddhist teachings on compassion, which, you know, involving exchanging of self and others, you know, which is premised upon the practice where you ignore, you know, yourself and promote others' well-being. But what the point being made here is that don't beat yourself up. But sometimes it can be read that way, you know, when it's translated into a different language. Mm-hmm. So this is, these are sensitive issues that people need to take into account. So these, what this indicates that when it dealing with these things, it is not adequate simply to pick it up from a book. You need to study them. So if you look at a standard model of the great writings of the Nalanda masters, they generally tend to have three stages in their text. Well, the first part is the, you know, a statement of many other viewpoints, and then they critique them, that this is not good enough, that's not good enough. They critique them. Then the second stage, then they present their own perspectives. And the third stage is then they raise possible objections to their position and then respond to those possible criticism. So in order to, you know, respond to the criticism, you have to anticipate the critical objections. So it is in this way that a topic is studied.
That's the way scientists write good grant proposals.
Research project de chebe kal proposal te gurba proposal pu thap ti bena de ge tigure sa thambu ge shen to kar che ye
that's
true
so this the level la ku go da
and when you do that you're really making your brain work
shen ma zu mi khal ne yes and yes minister chen ya yo ma re
so otherwise if you just simply become, you know, say whatever other people say, if you say yes, then you become yes minister.
So, Your Holiness, we've reached the end of our morning. Oh. Thank you for your generosity in spending time with us.
Thank you.
And kindness, too.